So welcome back, everybody. So lecture 8, I hope you were happy with lectures 6 and 7, taught by Maria and Nitika. Today, we continue with the concept of shape. How do we describe that the manifold has some shape? And remember that this is going to be the topic of the essay. Project is going to be one thing, the essay is going to be about shape. There are, in fact, several different ways in which the shape of a manifold can be described, and it is not settled yet which will be the appropriate way, the optimal way, to describe shape when it comes to quantizing curvature, when it comes to quantizing space-time itself. So there are competing approaches, and who knows what will win. This is the main motivation for why the topic of the essay is this, how to describe the shape of things. So for example, if we take a potato-shaped manifold, then we can draw a triangle on that potato-shaped manifold surface, I mean on that potato surface, and it might have a right angle in here. But then there's no guarantee that a squared plus b squared is c squared. Pythagoras' law is true on a flat space, but in general it's not true. So a squared plus b squared is not c squared, even if one angle is 90 degrees. What that means is that if you experimentally did this, you built a triangle with lines that are as straight as possible, and you make sure that one angle is a right angle, and you can measure a squared plus b squared and check whether it is c squared. And if it's different from c squared, then you know it's got to be some sort of non-trivial shape. And you could imagine systematically doing this with small triangles and measure the deficiency between the actual Pythagoras and the observed Pythagoras. And that would give you a handle on what the shape of the manifold is, if you know at every location how much a deviation would be. This is not historically how it went. There are other ways to capture the shape of manifolds, but you can see how that might be an approach that could work. Similarly, the sum of the angles in a triangle in a plane is 180 degrees, pi half. But in general, of course, on the surface of a potato, it's not going to be 180 degrees. Again, you could imagine taking small triangles and noting at every location what the deficiency angle is, how much it deviates for certain triangles, the sum of the angles, how much it deviates from being 180 degrees. And there are indeed approaches to quantum gravity that are based on that idea of deficiency angles as a means to describe the curvature of a space-time. In fact, even Helmholtz and Gauss were visionary enough to not only see that this is the case, but also to understand that the three-dimensional space that we live in might be curved, that even in three dimensions, the angle sum may not be 180 degrees, and Pythagoras may not hold. And I think it was Gauss who actually went out and measured this. I think he measured the sum of the angles, taking three peaks of mountains and then building a triangle this way and measuring angles. Of course, his accuracy was not enough to measure the deviation, but in principle, of course, there is a deviation even on Earth. Now, we defined last week the metric tensor. Now, the idea with the metric tensor was we use it to describe the shape of a manifold. And the underlying principle is this. G mu nu of x allows us to calculate infinitesimal distances, small distances. But we can iterate that and then calculate large distances from that. But if we can calculate large distances, well, then we can check what the shape of a manifold is. If we have the mutual distances between any two points of a manifold, then from just knowing the distances, we can work out whether or not there is curvature. Now, here's an alternative idea. And we will pursue this idea today. When I say alternative, I mean it's really possible to use this approach instead of the metric. So we now know how the metric works. This approach that we will pursue today works even if we had no idea about the existence of a metric. It's a completely fresh approach to describing how a manifold can be curved. And here the basic principle is this. A manifold's shape, that is to say its curvature, reveals itself also in the non-triviality of parallel transport. Imagine, for example, here the floor of this room. Well, this is flat. If I point with my arm in some direction, and then I walk a parallelogram, and while I walk the parallelogram, I parallel transport my arm. Well, then, at the end of the walk, my arm is still pointing in the same direction. That may look trivial, but it's not actually trivial. Imagine I did a much, I did this on a very different surface, such as the surface of the Earth. If I start on the North Pole, and I point in some direction, I think I mentioned that example earlier, that direction is always going to be south, because I'm standing on the North Pole, so I'm pointing south. And now I walk all the way to the equator, parallel transporting my arm. And then I walk along the equator, in small steps to the left, always parallel transporting my arm. And then I walk up to the North Pole. Now my arm will have rotated compared to where it was when I started that trip. It would never happen on a flat background, but on a curved background, that's what happens. So the non-triviality of parallel transport is also an indication of non-triviality of this shape of a manifold. Just like alternatively the metric is, or deficiency angles, or Pythagoras violation. And there are other ways as well to describe non-triviality of shape. For example, you could take a piece of metal that's flat, and then attach a string to it, and let it dangle. And you take a spoon, tap on it, it will make a sound. Now imagine you take the same surface area of metal, same size metal, but it has some non-trivial shape. For example, it might be rolled up and be a ball, or like a vase. Now if you tap it with a spoon, it will sound very differently. So clearly, the eigenspectrum with which a manifold vibrates, if you give it vibrational degrees of freedom, also carries information about the shape of it. That leads to the discipline of spectral geometry, which asks, how much can we tell about the shape of an object from the vibration spectrum that it has? And I will tell you more about that later. Anyway, so there are many different ways to describe the non-triviality of shape. We don't know yet which one will be the appropriate one for quantizing gravity, so we will do a few of them. The metric one we already did, and we will get, of course, much more into detail about the metric one. Now we'll do this approach, the non-triviality of parallel transport, then we will show how that relates to the metric, and we will go on from there. Okay, so that was the example of the North Pole, where we parallel transport, let's say, the pointy finger, and then we walk along the equator, and then we walk back to the North Pole, and then the hand has rotated. In practice, we won't do a triangle like this. In practice, we will do a parallelogram. So we walk in a parallelogram, always parallel transporting our arm, and then we ask, by what angle has our hand rotated? Of course, in three dimensions, or even in four dimensions, this is not going to be just one angle. It's going to be a rotation. Right? So if I start with a vector in any arbitrary direction, and I parallel transport it while I go on a parallelogram in space and time, and then I come back, then that vector will have rotated. So the outcome of a parallel transport along a parallelogram is a rotation matrix. And that rotation matrix, as a function of the parallelogram that you choose, that's going to be the Riemann curvature tensor. Okay. So the idea that the non-triviality of parallel transport encodes the shape of a manifold leads to the idea that we should define how a vector changes when parallel transported. So we are going to calculate now the derivative of vectors with respect to parallel transport. And then basically the commutator of the derivative in one direction and the derivative in the other direction gives us the description of a parallelogram, because it means I go either in the direction A and then the direction B, or first in B and then in A, and I take the difference between the two, that's going to be the rotation matrix. So for infinitesimal parallel transport, that's going to be a derivative. So that rotation matrix, the Riemann curvature tensor later, will arise from the commutator of parallel transport, of infinitesimal parallel transport. This is not supposed to be completely clear at the moment. I just want to give you an indication where this is going. Okay, for now, let me remind you that we had already the Lie derivative, which was a directional derivative of vectors and tensors in general. But the Lie derivative we defined before we even introduced the metric. So very important, keep in mind the Lie derivative doesn't care about the metric. It doesn't occur in the definition of the Lie derivative. And in particular, if you choose two vector fields, Xi1 and Xi2, to be, for example, the directional derivatives in the I and in the J direction, well then from the formula that the commutator of the Lie derivatives is the Lie derivative of the commutator, this is going to be zero. But that's not what we want, right? We want something non-trivial here. You parallel transport in one direction, a vector that points in some other direction, how does it change? If the manifold is some curved manifold, then this should be non-trivial. So in general, if you calculate the infinitesimal parallel transport of one vector in the direction of another vector, that's what we want here, that shouldn't come out to be zero. Of course, this is zero because the commutator of two vector fields, of these two vector fields, is zero, because they're just d by dxi, d by dxj, they commute. Okay, so we need something other. There we go. Why is this so slow? It's not actually the transmission to the projector here. Oh, I see. Okay, got it. Yeah, every other page. Okay, so what we introduce is yet another differentiation. It's not like we've seen too few differentiations so far, right? Yet another one, super important, the covariant derivative, covariant differentiation. And you guessed it's going to be a derivation too. But how? So the definition is that any linear map of tangent vector fields that take two tangent vector fields and map them into a tangent vector field, so it's the derivative of a tangent vector field in the direction of another tangent vector field. Like, I'm pointing with my arm in this way, and I'm walking in that direction. Okay, so I need two direction vectors for this, one direction vector, one tangent vector to tell me in which direction my arm is pointing, and one tangent vector to tell me in which direction I'm walking. Then the covariant derivative is supposed to tell me in which direction my hand, even though I'm parallel transporting, it is changing, right? Okay, so it takes in two direction vectors and it gives you a direction vector. And we will write it in this way. So we take the two tangent vectors here and they're being mapped by the covariant derivative into nabla xi eta. So this is the covariant derivative of the tangent vector field eta in the direction of the vector field xi. This is where the arm is pointing. This is where I'm walking. Okay, so any linear map of tangent vector fields that obeys these two conditions is called a covariant derivative, or also equivalently, it is called an affine connection. and the two rules that this so-called affine connection or covariant derivative has to obey are these two rules. Let me explain what they are. So first, the covariant derivative of a vector field in the direction of xi, remember this is where the arm is pointing, this is the direction I'm stepping, is supposed to be f times the covariant derivative of eta in the direction of xi. Super important, it means here we can pull functions simply out of the covariant derivative. This is simply saying if I make a larger step, right, so I take my arm, and now I make a larger step or a smaller step, that's a prefactor here, that's simply directly multiplying what the covariant derivative is. Right? So if I make a twice as large a step, I get twice as much of a change of the vector that my arm is pointing into. And of, yeah. The vector that describes where my arm is pointing is changing twice as much. And this is not only allowed to be a number, but a function. Because it's just simply a scaling factor, you know? Because remember that this vector field simply indicates in which direction I'm stepping. Okay. On the other hand, if I take the covariant derivative of a scalar function times a vector field, then the Leibniz rule kicks in. This was sheer linearity. We always have simple linearity in this argument, which tells us in which direction we are differentiating. But here, we have a function multiplying what we are differentiating. Right? This is only changing in which direction we are differentiating. This is the f here is changing what we are differentiating. And therefore, there should be a Leibniz rule here. And the Leibniz rule is going to be that the covariant derivative of a function times a tangent vector field is given by the covariant derivative of the function times the tangent vector field plus the function times the covariant derivative of the tangent vector field. Okay, Leibniz rule. But what is the covariant derivative of a function? Well, by definition, the covariant derivative of a function is the ordinary derivative. You remember that perhaps from a previous course on general relativity? The covariant derivative of a function is just the ordinary derivative. The Christoffel symbols only arise for vectors and higher tensors. So by we require the Leibniz rule to hold, and the covariant derivative of a function is simply the ordinary derivative of the function, which is to say, you know, the ordinary directional derivative of a function. Right. This is simply the tangent vector applied to the function. Tangent vector applied to the function is the directional derivative. Okay, so what we have is the two axioms for the covariant derivative is any map that takes two tangent vector fields and maps them into a tangent vector field such that we have linearity in the argument that describes the direction in which we differentiate is simply linear. And we have also the Leibniz rule with respect to the argument of the covariant derivative, where we have that the covariant derivative of a function times a vector field is the covariant derivative of the function, which is the directional derivative, which is just the evaluation of the tangent vector, times the tangent vector, plus leaving the function alone and covariantly differentiating our tangent vector field. So for now, we are assuming that the metric has not yet been specified. This is supposed to be a completely fresh approach to describing the curvature of manifolds. Later we will relate this to a metric, but we could just drop the idea that there is a metric and do general relativity with only this, only the covariant derivative, the affine connection. And we could do it also exclusively only with a metric. It just is much more convenient to use both later. Okay, so then how does the covariant derivative look like in a chart? See, obviously, the two axioms don't specify our covariant derivative yet. And how much freedom do we have in defining covariant derivatives? How much freedom do we have in defining affine connections? It turns out there are as many affine connections as there are curve manifolds. In fact, a little bit more, because it also describes manifolds with curvature, with not just with curvature, but also with torsion. But more about this later. So we still have a lot of freedom in defining affine connections. We just gave the axioms. Now let's see how we can actually specify an affine connection explicitly. And then later we find out what that means for what kind of manifold we have described. So for now, the structure is, how can we define from scratch some affine connection? Let's worry later about what kind of shape that actually describes. So how does the covariant derivative look like in a chart? Well, let's choose a coordinate system, and then let's choose a basis for the tangent vectors. For example, these guys are tangent vectors. We can use them as a basis, as we have previously established. Let's keep in mind, there are a gazillion, infinitely many other bases we could choose, but for convenience, we start with choosing these basis vectors. Then, given a covariant derivative nabla, we consider its action on these basis vectors. Or let's put it this way, by specifying how the covariant derivative handles these guys, we are specifying what affine connection we are dealing with. So for example, we could choose for the two tangent vectors, two of these basis vectors. So for example, we can ask, what is the affine connection, what is the covariant derivative of this tangent vector? Remember, that's the direction in which my arm is pointing, in the j direction, if I step into the I direction. This is going to give me some rotated vector. It's giving me in which direction my arm is changing, right? So changing its direction, infinitesimally, there is a bit of a vector to be attached to take into account what happens if, for example, I walk to the equator and then along the equator and then back. So any change of a tangent vector is itself a tangent vector. And here we're calculating the infinitesimal change, the direction in which a tangent vector is changing if we step in the I direction. And the vector that we are parallel transporting is pointing in the J direction. So the outcome of that is going to be some vector. It's going to be the change of direction vector, right? It's the rate of change of direction vector. And so it's got to be a linear combination of the basis vectors again. So let's just write down coefficient functions here. See, it's got to be a linear combination of these basis vectors. So therefore, the k index needs to be summed over. But also, what linear combination it is depends on which two vectors we took here. So the indices I and j also occur here. So we have these so-called Christoffel symbols here occurring. And you can see now what's happening. This is where we get to choose our affine connection. So if we want to describe a particular curve manifold, we can describe it, we can specify it by specifying exactly these functions here. It's not easy to see what manifold we get if we choose some bunch of functions there. But in principle, you can just go ahead and do this. So just pull functions out of a hat that you call gamma k ij in your coordinate system, and they might just give you an affine connection here. Later we will see that there's good reason to choose these gammas to be symmetric in ij, but for now we have no reason to even assume that. Okay, so we define an affine connection in this way by just pulling functions gamma k ij out of a hat. Space-time dependent ones. These are called the connection coefficients. And if we choose these to be wild functions, then we're guaranteed that our manifold is going to be wrinkly, going to be wild, because parallel transport is going to be wild. almost guaranteed. It could be that these are wild functions and the manifold is completely flat. We'll see later how that can happen. But generically, it's not going to happen. You would have to design it in this way. Okay, so then once we've defined what our affine connection does with the basis vector fields, we can now use the two axioms to deduce what the affine connection has to do with all vector fields. So let's say we want to covariantly differentiate, after we've chosen these functions, just pulled them out of the hat, we want now to calculate the covariant derivative of the eta vector field in the xi direction. Well, how do we do that? Let's write out what the xi field is. In the basis, this is coefficient functions times basis vectors. That's the direction in which we are stepping. And you see it's a space-time direction, a space-time dependent direction vector, because the xi can depend on space and time. I'm just not writing the argument here because it would just clutter up the notation. But of course, this is a space-time dependent tangent vector field. And then what we are covariantly differentiating, the eta, is also a space-time dependent tangent vector field. And remember the structure of this. This is a basis vector in the tangent vector space, and this is a function. Right? Even though it has indices, for each fixed value of j, this is just a scalar function. This is not a vector, this is a scalar function. That's a vector. It's a basis vector, and this is a coefficient function in front of it. This is scalar. This is in lambda naught. This is a bunch of zero forms. And these are tangent vectors. All right, so this is just spelling out what xi and eta are in a basis. And then we use the first axiom. Remember, the first axiom said that if you multiply here with a number or function, you can pull this in front of the nabla. You have complete linearity in that argument here. In this argument, we don't. There we have the Leibniz rule. But in this argument, we have linearity. Let's use this. Here we have prefactor functions. And here we have basis vectors. These prefactor functions we can pull out. And that's what we do here. We write here the derivative basis vectors, these ones. And then the xi I we can pull out by the first axiom of affine connections. And this I just carried forward for now. Now remember, these are coefficient functions. And these are vectors. Remember that the covariant derivative of these basis vectors we can already calculate, because we pulled these functions out of the hat. We chose an affine connection, therefore we chose a manifold. We chose a shape of a manifold. And how do we calculate the covariant derivative of these coefficient functions? Well, remember that the covariant derivative in the xi direction of a function is simply xi, the tangent vector, applied to that function. Remember, tangent vectors are directional derivatives. Okay, so we can do that now. We are using the Leibniz rule on this product of two arguments. So what we have is we take this xi I and pull it here in front, and then we apply the Leibniz rule to this product, which gives us two terms by the Leibniz rule, this term and that term. The first term arises when we do the covariant derivative of the eta. But the covariant derivative of the eta is the ordinary directional derivative of the function. So it's simply this scalar function differentiated in the direction of this tangent vector, which is to say, we take eta j and differentiate it in the I direction. This is eta j comma I, which is d eta j by dxi. Right? Remember the notation? Comma I just means differentiate with respect to d by dxi. So in the first term in the application of the Leibniz rule, we get the covariant derivative of the scalar function, which is just the ordinary derivative of the scalar function, carrying forward the second argument. Plus, by the Leibniz rule, we have to leave this term alone, which is carried forward. Here it is. And then we have the covariant derivative of this basis vector in the direction of that basis vector. But that is what we put in. That's our input. So that thing goes in here. And now we have the full covariant derivative of eta in the xi direction right here. It's the xi I and then this thing here and these coefficients. And I just arranged the index structure so that we could put the d by dxk out there. So I just renamed the JK over there so that these two terms could be put together in a bracket, the two terms from the product rule, from Leibniz rule, and the d by dxk over there. So this is the coefficient function. This whole thing here, with all of its indices, is just a scalar function. It's a coefficient function in front of these basis vectors. It's a vector field, right? Coefficient function times, okay, coefficient functions times basis vectors. Okay. Now this thing, we give a name here. If we write that eta k semicolon I is this sum, you see here we have eta k comma I, and here we have eta j and then the gammas. If this combination, we give that name, the eta k with the semicolon I, this scalar function is just given that name, then that expression here simplifies a bit because this then is simply the eta k semicolon I. Right? So the xi I we pull out of this bracket and the d by dxk we pull out and all the eta business we put together as this notation, eta k semicolon I. So therefore, the covariant derivative of a tangent vector field in the direction of another tangent vector field is given by this expression here, where we have linearity in the first argument, but we have this semicolon business here, which is non-trivial because it's actually the sum of two terms. Now, what about these terms? Remember, the gamma, these gamma kij, they were our chance to specify what manifold you want to work with. Choosing the eta kij wildly meant that we are going to have, in general, some potato-shaped manifold, some complicated manifold. This was the input. Choosing the eta, the gamma kij, the so-called Christoffel symbols, was to choose the shape of the manifold because it was to choose the non-triviality of parallel transport. Now let's see what properties these guys have. It turns out this thing, even though it has an upper and two lower indices, is not a tensor. This is not a one-fold contravariant and two-fold covariant tensor, even though it has this index structure. I mean, in any case, this is just coefficient functions after all, right? A tensor is something else. Whenever you have these functions with these indices up and down, they are scalar functions. Once you contract them with basis vectors, then you may get a tensor. But these guys themselves, for every fixed kij, this is a scalar function. And we can ask, how do they change as I change coordinates? If, along with the change of coordinates, we are also changing the basis in the tangent and cotangent space. See, when we choose the x coordinates, we tend to choose as basis vectors in the tangent space, d by dx1, d by dx2, etc. When we use the coordinate system of the x bar, we tend to choose for our basis vectors d by dx bar 1, d by dx bar 2, the basis vectors of the tangent space. And that induces the dual basis in the cotangent space, etc., etc. But you see, in principle, we are free to choose whichever basis we want in a tangent space or cotangent space, no matter what coordinate system. Later, we will make use of that freedom. A lot went wrong in the early studies of general relativity when people still believed that you had to make a particular choice in your tangent vectors, in your tangent vector spaces or cotangent vector spaces that was associated to a coordinate system. No, choosing coordinate system is one thing. Choosing bases is another thing. But for now, we keep them together, which you can do. You can choose your bases to be the d by dxi or the d by dx bar I, why not? You can, and you will see things in a familiar language. But later, keep in mind, we will free ourselves from that. Okay, so if we do that, if we stick with the canonical, so-called canonical bases of the tangents, cotangent spaces that come along with the coordinate system, well then, let's see what is the covariant derivative of the d by dx bar B vector field in the direction of the D by dx bar A vector field? Well, by definition, this is going to be some Christoffel symbol times the basis vectors that we've chosen now. The question is, how are these barred Christoffel symbols related to the unbarred ones? Now, the d by dx bar, well, this is a tangent vector, and we can calculate how it changes under the change of coordinates, namely by this. You could remember that tangent vectors transform like this, but you can also just consider that this is the chain rule simply, right? D by dxk, dxk by dx bar, that's d by dx bar, right? So from here to here, it's just application of the chain rule. So on one hand, we have that the covariant derivative of this vector field with respect to that one is given by this expression, where here we have the unbarred basis vectors. On the other hand, we can do this. We calculate the covariant derivative of this vector field, of this barred vector field with respect to that barred vector field, both basis vector fields. Then what do we get? Well, we can spell out what this is. Again, using the chain rule, we can express this in terms of the basis of the unbarred variables. That's useful because we know how the covariant derivative that we chose, like 10 minutes ago, how this thing acts on the unbarred coordinate system. Right? And we want to reduce this to what we know happens in the unbarred coordinate system. So we have here the chain rule factor. These guys are just functions, scalar functions. So we can pull them in front of it, right? Remember the two axioms of the covariant derivative. Complete linearity with respect to the first argument, but Leibniz rule with respect to the main argument. Okay, so we have this, and then also this barred tangent vector can be written using the chain rule in this way. So what we have to do is pull this in front. That's happened here, going from here to there. This chain rule factor was pulled out of the covariant derivative, and here we have now to evaluate the covariant derivative of this product. This being a tangent vector, this being a function. Remember how that works? We have to differentiate covariantly this function, leaving that alone, plus leaving this alone and covariantly differentiating that vector. Okay, so this is in front of everything. Here it is. And then here we have the two terms from the Leibniz rule. The first term arises when we covariantly differentiate this scalar function. Now, that the derivative of the scalar function, you know, this is just a direction vector field applied to a function that's literally doing that directional derivative. So it's d by dxi on that scalar function, leaving that tangent vector field the same. And then the second term arises when we leave that function the same. Here it is, just carried forward. And then we have the covariant derivative of this unbarred vector field with respect to that unbarred vector field. But this is what we started with at the beginning. We specified what that is, the covariant derivative of d by dxj with respect to d by dxi. These were the gamma, the Christoffel symbols that we started out with, that we defined when we chose our manifold. So we can plug that in here. So we get all of this. And then right, so what do we have? We have here this carried forward. We have that this multiplies that. So, okay, that's easy, right? So this factor multiplies that. We have that here. And then we have that in principle, we have here chain rule factor derivative. But because we have here, let me see, d by dxi, d by dxi, d by dx bar, these two together are simply d by dxa. It's a chain rule, so we have this. We can write it like that. All right. So now we can use this together with what we had over here, namely, here we calculated the covariant derivative of the Barth vector fields with respect to each other. There we calculated it. It was that. So now we can compare the two. We can say that this has to be equal to that. And what we obtain, therefore, is that this expression that comes from the first equation is equal to that expression that comes from the second equation. Now, we want to express the Christoffel symbols with the bar in terms of the Christoffel symbols without the bar. So we take this matrix here and multiply with its inverse so that this acts on the right. And if our coordinate transformations always required to be invertible, so therefore this matrix is also invertible, and therefore we can do this. When we do that, we get rid of this matrix over here, and we multiply with that matrix over there. Here it is, and there it is. Now, the inverse of that matrix is literally the same thing, but with the barred quantities up and the unbarred quantities down. So there we have it. The transformation properties of the Christoffel symbol functions under change of coordinates, if we change simultaneously our basis vectors in the tangent and cotangent spaces accordingly, so that they are always the canonical basis vectors that come with the coordinate system, the d by dx i's. And what we can tell from this is that these guys cannot be the coefficient functions of a tensor. Because if they were the coefficient functions of a tensor, the first term would have to be absent. This is exactly the transformation rule for the coefficient functions of a tensor, that's one-fold contravariant, two-fold covariant, if this is absent. Right? You have that these lower, the covariant indices transform correctly with this Jacobian, and the upper contravariant index transforms correctly with that Jacobian. Just this thing messes things up badly. Because it means that even if gamma was chosen to be zero, then by choosing some funny coordinate system with some funny dependence of the new coordinates of the old coordinates, we can have that this is non-zero. So even though gamma is zero, like we start with Minkowski space, and then we look at Minkowski space in funny coordinates, then we get this. So the gamma bar is that. And of course, you know what the physics of that is, right? These are pseudo forces. The forces that drive, that if you go in a car around a curve, you know, you're pushed towards the side of the car. These are these pseudo forces. But we'll get to that in more detail later. Okay, so these guys definitely are not, the Christoffel symbols are not the coefficients functions of a tensor. Now, what is the definition of a covariant derivative the physicist's way, the old-fashioned way? It is to say that any set of n to the 3 functions, gamma RAB of x, which transform under change of coordinates in this way, and you can just legislate that, so you just pull these functions out of the hat in some coordinate system and then say, well, you want to know what these functions are in another coordinate system, use this. And there you go. You've defined your affine connection all over space-time for all coordinate systems. So the physics definition is this. Affine connection is any collection of scalar functions like this, which once defined in some coordinate system, in any other coordinate system, are obtained in this way. Now, why is that a physics definition? It is because implicit in this is the assumption that with the change of coordinates, you change bases in your tangent spaces. And mathematicians realized that's not necessary. These are two independent things, as we will later see. I mean, we see it already. It's just later we will make use of it. Okay, now, the absolute covariant derivative. That's no big deal. The idea is simply this. The covariant derivative requires, so far, but you give it two vectors. One is the direction, the tangent vector, in which specifies in which direction your arm is pointing, right? And then the other direction vector, the one that's written down there, is pointing in the direction that you are walking, right? And so you're asking, how much does this vector change? In which direction does this vector change if I walk in that direction, for example? Now, you could also ask, what if I don't specify in which direction I'm going to walk? And I leave it open. Then what? So can I calculate the derivative where you feed in your direction, your tangent vector field, but you just leave it open in which direction you may walk? Meaning that you get an object which is asking for a tangent vector field to specify in which direction you want to walk. And then it gives you the covariant derivative. That's all there is. It's simply the ordinary covariant derivative omitting the specification of the direction in which you want to walk. So the absolute covariant derivative is defined in this way. Consider the covariant derivative, but without choosing a direction vector xi. So now, this is going to be, and this is the nabla without an argument down here, it's taking a tangent vector field, such as in which direction your arm is pointing, and it's mapping it again into a tangent vector field, but it also will have a covariant index. Why a covariant index? Well, a covariant index is an opening where you can plug in a tangent vector. Okay? So it's waiting for a tangent vector, and if you give it a tangent vector, namely the direction in which you want to step, then it will give you the ordinary covariant derivative. So for example, the covariant derivative then of some tangent vector field eta, coefficient functions times basis vectors, the absolute covariant derivative then is going to be the covariant derivative of, I mean, we will write it like this, covariant derivative of the tangent vector field eta. And here I'm putting x just to remind you that this is a field, space-time dependent, right? This eta are x dependent. This thing here is defined to be, remember, no xi down here. We haven't specified which direction we want to function, we want to differentiate. This is by definition then, this thing with the coefficient function with the semicolon, and then here the direction vectors as usual, except that in principle we would have to contract here with the xi I. That would be the, here, the xi I. But we don't, because we don't know what the xi is yet. We want to leave that slot open. So we take this I index and contract it with the dxi. Because that is asking for a tangent vector to be plugged in. And once we plug in that tangent vector, xi id by dxi, right, in here, then that will be just a Kronecker delta, and we will get the xi I and the usual direction derivative. Okay, so if we take the absolute covariant derivative of eta, which is waiting for a tangent vector field to be filled into its covariant slot, if we take this absolute covariant derivative of eta and we feed it the direction vector field xi, so xi is a vector field that tells us in which direction we want to take a step. If we do that, then what do we get? According to this definition, we get the semicolon derivative, the covariant derivative, these basis vectors over there, and then this xi tangent vector gets eaten up by that covariant part. And what is it? What is dxi applied to a tangent vector? Well, that's, of course, a tangent vector applied to the coefficient function xi I. And that's, of course, giving us the Kronecker delta between the d by dxi on, and the xj, and we're just left with the coefficients xi I. So we get the eta k, ji, xi I, and this, which is, of course, just what we had defined earlier to be the covariant derivative of eta in the direction of xi. And here I'm writing out explicitly again, but you should remember that from the first or second lecture. the application of a cotangent vector on a tangent vector, right? A cotangent vector on a tangent vector is the same as xi applied to xi, but xi is coefficient function times d by dxi, and that is to be applied to the coordinate function xi. The derivative applied to the coordinate function gives us the Kronecker delta, and then we just get the xi I. And that's how this becomes just the xi I. So far, we defined the covariant derivative algebraically by simply saying it's any linear map that obeys these two axioms, linearity in the first argument, and product rule, Leibniz rule, in the second argument. Now, let's look at it geometrically. You see, if the covariant derivative is to describe infinitesimal parallel transport, then it should also describe finite parallel transport. And finite parallel transport, we have some idea about. We know intuitively what that should be. So let's start with the definition. Assume that a covariant derivative is given. So we've chosen our Christoffel symbols. We know how to calculate covariant derivatives, which is to say, effectively, we've chosen the shape of our manifold, even though it's not clear yet how to extract that shape information at all. We should anticipate that fixing the gammas was fixing the shape. So let's say we have given ourselves an affine connection, a covariant derivative, by specifying a bunch of these Christoffel symbol functions in some coordinate system. Now, let's choose a path in our manifold. What's a path in the manifold? Well, it's a map from the real numbers, which you can think of as a time parameter, into the manifold. So here we have our path gamma, and it passes through the point P, and there's a tangent vector. We can look at tangent vectors at that point P. Now imagine here is the path gamma described by a function from the real numbers into the manifold. And for example, when the parameter is zero, we might run through the point P. And of course, we have a tangent vector then there. That was the geometric definition of what a tangent vector is. And now imagine that we have on this manifold not just this path. No, imagine that on this manifold, we also have a tangent vector field. A tangent vector field that's defined here and there and there and there and everywhere, and also on the path. Because it's defined everywhere, it's also defined for every point of that path. So at every point, we can ask, well, what is our tangent vector field, eta, in the manifold on this point? So that vector field eta, we can evaluate here, there, there, everywhere. But we can also evaluate it here, or even at the point P. That's where the tangent vector field is. And then we say that this tangent vector field is orthoparallel along this path if, according to our covariant derivative, the tangent vector field doesn't change along the path. So if, when we calculate the covariant derivative of our vector field eta, in the direction of our path, gamma dot is the tangent to the path. Right? So if eta is a field everywhere defined, which on the path doesn't change according to the parallel transport that we defined, then we say that this field is orthoparallel. So this does not mean that the eta field actually points in the direction of the tangent vectors of our path. Does it? Instead, what it means is that eta is parallel transported. Remember the exercise where I was standing on the North Pole, pointing in some direction, and then walking down to the equator, and then walking left, and then walking up to the North Pole again. Always parallel transporting my arm. Right? So I was creating a vector field while I did that. At every point where I was, my arm was pointing somewhere. It wasn't pointing in the direction I walk, but it was pointing somewhere. Right? So I was walking around, always parallel transporting my arm. And that vector field was parallel transported. It was auto-parallel with respect to the path that I traveled. Okay, so for example, if I'm standing here and my arm is pointing that way, and then according to the affine connection, the derivative is zero, and what it means is that if this vector points later in that direction, well, so be it. According to our affine connection, we actually parallel transported this vector. So choosing the covariant derivative is to choose the shape of the manifold in the sense that it is to choose what it means to parallel transport a vector field. So remember, a tangent vector field eta that may be defined everywhere in the manifold is called autoparallel along the path, on the path, if, according to the covariant derivative, it doesn't change along the path. Because if we differentiate eta in the direction that we travel, in the direction of gamma dot, then that's zero. It turns out that the condition that that we are writing down here is, of course, in any coordinate system that you may choose, it is a differential equation. And it turns out that from the theory of ordinary differential equation, of ordinary differential equations, after all, this only depends on the time derivatives, time being the parameter of our path, one can prove that for sufficiently smooth Christoffel symbols and the manifold, we always have a finite region that we can parallel transport. Child abduction. Well, the child is not in this room. Okay. All right. What, did you hear the alarm before? Oh, okay. All right. Okay, so it turns out that you can always parallel transport in this way. You can give yourself an affine connection and then choose a direction in which your arm is pointing and then solve that equation, that differential equation, along the path. And this is what it means to parallel transport your arm along some path. So now we know how to calculate the parallel transport of a particular direction in which you're pointing on your manifold. Once you've chosen the affine connection, once you've chosen your Christoffel symbols, you're committed. You have defined already parallel transport. We started by defining infinitesimal parallel transport by defining the covariant derivative, but by defining autoparallel, we extended that to finite parallel transport. And the theory of ODEs tells us that we can always parallel transport at least some finite amount in this way. So in practice, it looks like this. In a chart, we have that the tangent vector field looks like this. Our path in the manifold maps a time interval from A to B into the manifold. We might call this parameter T really for time, but of course, it doesn't have to be the time. It's just some parameter. And then our tangent vector field at the point x of t is given by, well, d by dt. But d by dt, by the chain rule, is d by dxk times dxk by dt. We've had that earlier when we did the geometric definition of tangent vectors. Okay, so let's calculate now the covariant derivative of a vector field in the direction of the tangent to the path. Here we have the tangent to the path. You know, this chain rule factor here. No, the tangent vector is just d by dt. T is the parameter, but that's d by dxk by dt, d by dxk. This factor can again be pulled out of the covariant derivative because it has full linearity with respect to the first argument. Then the second argument here again has a coordinate function and basis vectors. We need the Leibniz rule for this. Okay, so first, by the first axiom of covariant derivatives, we pull this scalar function out. That's what happened here. Now we have to do the covariant derivative of this product. Covariant derivative of this function is just the ordinary derivative of that function. And then we also get the covariant derivative of this. And that gives us the Christoffel symbols. Here we have all that. Right? So the ordinary derivative of the eta, that's here. And then we have the covariant derivative of the tangent vector. That's given by the Christoffel symbols, and this function just pulls out. All right. Then by the chain rule, these two go away, and this whole expression just becomes d eta I by dt. That's what we have here. And then we carry that forward. We say that this is equal to zero, but that has to be true for all of the basis vectors. The coefficient functions have to vanish for all of the basis vectors here. And therefore, as I promised earlier, the orthoparallel equation is an ordinary differential equation for the coefficients eta I of our vector field. So remember that the x of t is the path that we travel. That's given. The Christoffel symbols are given. And we want to know if we start pointing in this direction and we travel down the path, what are the coordinates of the vector that describes where I'm pointing to later on? And these coordinates are the eta I of t. And here, this is the bunch of differential equations. For every I, this is a differential equation that has to obey. Okay, so now we can parallel transport any arbitrary vector eta in this way. So the conclusion is, this is a first order ordinary differential equation for eta. Therefore, the initial condition, one initial condition, because it's first order, one initial condition tells us that there's going to be a solution specified for a finite range of time. Okay, and so the proposition is that given a path and given an affine connection, so we've chosen our Christoffel symbol functions, the parallel transport of a vector field eta is unique. At least locally it is, as far as the ODE is integrable. Okay, so what we have therefore is this. You know, where I'm going now is this. We can now covariantly differentiate vector fields. How about covariantly differentiating covector fields? How about covariantly differentiating general tensor fields? Well, the idea is we want to do that in a fully covariant way. And the best way to define that is with some geometric intuition. So what we've just seen can be interpreted in the following way. When we give ourselves a path in the manifold, path gamma, then along that path, we can now parallel transport vector fields. Always assuming we have given ourselves the Christoffel symbols, we've given ourselves an affine connection. Then whenever we choose a path, then because we have a covariant derivative, we have an affine connection, we have the Christoffel symbols, we can now parallel transport any vector we want. Like any eta can now be parallel transported along any path we want, at least some finite distance. Which means that any path gives us a parallel transport map tau, which maps tangent vectors to a point on the path, gamma of t, to a tangent vector at another point in the path, at another time s. Right? So at time t, we are at a point gamma of t in the manifold. We have a tangent vector there. And then after we travel the path for a while, we end up in another for a while, so to up until time s, then we are at the point gamma of s along that path, and then our tangent vector has become a tangent vector over there. So tau is a map that parallel transports vectors from one point in the manifold to another point in the manifold. So if we so any path gamma traveled for a parameter distance of one, let's say. So we start with the parameter value being zero, and then we parallel transport until the parameter of the path is one, then we get that vector fields get parallel transported. So we map eta of gamma of t to eta of gamma of s. Now, can we use tau, our parallel transport map, to obtain the covariant derivative as a Newton-Leibniz limit? So far we did it algebraically, geometrically, but we haven't really defined it as a limit for epsilon going to zero, f of x plus h minus f of x divided by h, h going to zero. Well, we can do this. And that's going to be useful because it generalizes to the covariant derivative of arbitrary tensors, covectors and tensors. For details of the proof, I refer you to the textbook by Straumann that is listed somewhere on the homepage of this course. Okay, so the proposition is that the covariant derivative in the direction of our path, in the direction of the tangent vector to our path, gamma dot being gamma of t differentiated with respect to the time. So the covariant derivative with respect to, in the direction of the tangent vector to the path, of a vector field eta evaluated at the point gamma of t is given by ds at s equal t of the parallel transport of our vector from point t to point s when in the limit where s is equal to zero. So we are just undoing what we did earlier. We defined the covariant derivative, which is of course an infinitesimal concept, and then we used this differential equation to integrate it up to get parallel transport over long distances. And now we have the parallel transport over long distances established by the map tau. And we take the infinitesimal limit where we just parallel transport infinitesimal distance, and then we get back our covariant derivative. Right, and it turns out that you could define your covariant derivative starting from that. So there is a Newton-Leibniz way of defining these things. We get the geometric definition of the covariant derivative in this way. Now, using this, we can define the covariant derivative for arbitrary tensors. So far, we only know how to covariantly differentiate functions and tangent vectors. And the covariant derivative of a function in the direction of xi is simply xi applied to the function. Right? Xi being a tangent vector and tangent vectors applied to functions. Direction derivative. And the covariant derivative of a tangent vector field is, of course, what the affine connection is all about. But what's the covariant derivative of a covector, for example, of a cotangent vector? Okay, so the parallel transport map transports tangent vectors, eta, from one point of the path to another point of the path. Now, we can define we can generalize the definition of our parallel transport map tau so that it also parallel transports the dual vectors omega, cotangent vectors, namely in the following way. The parallel transport is defined to be such that it doesn't matter whether you first parallel transport or you first take the inner product. So let's say you have a tangent vector and a cotangent vector. You can evaluate them against each other, right? And that gives you something like the length of one vector times the length of the other vector times the cosine of the angle between the two, right? Now, the parallel transport should not change that evaluation of a tangent vector against a cotangent vector. So you parallel transport the tangent vector, parallel transport your cotangent vector, then that evaluation that you get between them should be the same. So we define parallel transport of covectors such that is true. So what we want is that if you take a tangent vector at a point and a cotangent vector at that point, and you evaluate against them against each other, they're dual vectors after all, you get a number. Now you could, of course, also parallel transport your tangent vector. We already know how to do that. And then parallel transport your cotangent vector. We still don't know how to do this. But what we want is that this map, the parallel transport map of covectors, is such, if it is possible, such that if you now evaluate the image of omega against the image of eta under the parallel transport, you get the same number as if you did it earlier. It's a bit like in quantum mechanics, where you would have a Kett vector and a Bra vector, and you run the time evolution of both of them. Now one evolves with the unitary u, and the other one evolves with the unitary u dagger. So if you now first take evaluate the Bra against the Kett, you get some probability amplitude. Or you first evolve both of them with U and U dagger respectively, and then evaluate them against each other, you get the same evaluation of them against each other, and the same story here. So we define the parallel transport of covariant vectors such that this is true. Very important principle. And once we know how to do the parallel transport for cotangent vectors, well, then we know how to do the infinitesimal version of that, which is the covariant derivative. And we can extend tau, our parallel transport map, we extend our parallel transport map to tensor products. So the parallel transport map of the tensor product of two tensors, so this could be two tangent vector fields, two cotangent vector fields, or some weird tensors of high degrees, whatever. We can always take the tensor product between two tensors and we get a tensor again. Then the parallel transport of that should be given by the tensor product of the parallel transports. So these are the two principles we go by in order to generalize the covariant derivative. We only know how to do it for tangent vectors so far, but by saying that the parallel transport operates on cotangent vectors such that parallel transport and evaluation of Bras against Ketts or tangent against cotangent vectors commute, and that forming tensor product commutes with parallel transport, these principles generalize parallel transport to all tensors, and the infinitesimal version of parallel transport is covariant derivative, so we get the covariant derivative for all tensors in this way. Okay, so definition then, the covariant derivative of an arbitrary tensor at some point p in the direction of a direction vector field psi is then by definition, hence these two dots, is by definition given by the derivative of the tensor in the direction of a tangent vector to a path gamma through that point. Gamma of t should be, for t equals 0, the point p where we want to know the covariant derivative. So we just generalized the parallel transport map tau to cotangent fields and to tensor products by having these axioms of how the parallel transport ought to treat the evaluation of tangents against cotangent vectors and the tensor product formation. So we can assume we know how this operates on arbitrary tensors. So once we know how this operates on arbitrary tensors, and here we have one of those arbitrary tensors, we use it to parallel transport it, and then we calculate how that so parallel transported vector starts to change as we run the parameter of our path. So we give a Newton-Leibniz definition of the covariant derivative as the infinitesimal limit of the parallel transport. So if you want to know the covariant derivative of an arbitrary tensor at the point P in the direction of xi, then we need to find a path which runs through P and at time t equals 0 is at P and has as its tangent vector gamma dot the vector xi. And then for that path, we calculate the parallel transport map for tangent vectors. We know what the differential equation for that is. And then from that, from the two axioms that we just had, namely that evaluation commutes with parallel transport and tensor product formation commutes with parallel transport, we can get what this is for all tangent vector, for all tensors, and then we take the infinitesimal version of that. Right. And then, of course, we can also define the absolute covariant derivative, which is nothing but hiding something. We are not yet saying in which direction we want to differentiate. We are simply omitting the xi. And so we are saying the absolute covariant derivative of s, just like we defined the absolute covariant derivative of the tangent vector before. Now we define the absolute covariant derivative of arbitrary tensors by saying the absolute covariant derivative of an arbitrary tensor, once you feed it all of these arguments, you see a tensor, a contravariant tensor waits for covariant vector fields to be input. And a covariant tensor waits for a number of tangent vectors to be put in. And the general covariant and contravariant tensor waits for a bunch of tangent and cotangent vectors to be fed so that it evaluates to a number, right? And here I just explicitly wrote down what some tangent and cotangent vector fields that you can feed in so that our tangent, so that our tensor evaluates to a number, so that all slots are filled. And on top of all these, there's also xi still to be specified, the vector that describes the direction in which we want to differentiate. So the covariant derivative, the absolute covariant derivative is given by this the absolute covariant derivative takes all of the vectors and covectors that it needs to fill the slots of S and also xi, which describes the direction in which we want to differentiate. And by definition, it's simply what we would get if we took the ordinary covariant derivative as we just defined it, with all of the slots filled with tangent and cotangent vectors, and the ordinary covariant derivative with xi specified here, just as we did it before. Okay, so now what are the properties of this covariant derivative? Let's make things a bit more explicitly eventually. So the covariant derivative is actually a derivation, and basically it inherits the Leibniz rule because we defined it using Newton-Leibniz as a limit, d by ds, right? And so the d by ds obeys the Leibniz rule, so the nabla does. The covariant derivative of the tensor product of two tensors is given by, here we have the derivative, here we have the parallel transport of the tensor product, Newton-Leibniz derivative applied to these two, because remember, the parallel transport of the tensor product is the tensor product of the parallel transports. Okay, that was second axiom here. And then we have here the derivative of this plus the derivative of the second part. You see, this derivative acts on these two with the Leibniz rule, right? This has an S dependence and this has an S dependence, so we get these two terms. And so we have that the covariant derivative obeys this rule, which of course you recognize as the Leibniz rule, inherited from d by ds's obeyance of the Leibniz rule. Right. Now, what is important here is that, where is equation C? Did you see it?
It's a few slides back.
Oh, okay. How do we get there?
I
See, there we go. Okay, so remember this means that contractions commute with parallel transport, right? Contraction, because this, you can think of it as lower index, upper index, right? Contractions commute with parallel transport, and here we have it. Okay, so that means that the covariant derivative commutes with contractions. Okay, important thing to remember, because the parallel transport commutes, the infinitesimal version of parallel transport, which is the covariant derivative, commutes with contractions. Okay. So now, finally, in a chart, the action of the covariant derivative of tensors in a chart. Let's remember, this is how the covariant derivative acts on one of the basis vectors. And remember, this is just psi I d by dx k or whatever. And so you can pull this psi coefficient functions in front. That's what happened here. And then the covariant derivative of this one in the direction of one of the basis vectors, d by dxk, gives us the Christoffel symbol. So we have this. Now, what, though, is the covariant derivative now of a basis vector in the cotangent space? We should have that, right? Because we claim we already can differentiate. We can parallel transport cotangent vectors. We can parallel transport any arbitrary tensor. So we better be able to covariantly differentiate also the basis vectors of the cotangent space. Let's see how these things look explicitly. Okay. So let us consider now a tangent vector field and a cotangent vector field. And we differentiate, we covariantly differentiate them. Then on one hand, we have that, it's a bit annoying. Okay, so on one hand, we have that the covariant derivative in the xi direction of eta tensor omega is, because we have the Leibniz rule, as we just established a little while ago, we have its covariant derivative of 1 tensor plus etc. Inherited, as we just saw, from the Leibniz rule being obeyed by the d by ds. But you see, in here, we know this thing already very well. We are well informed about it because we invented it, right? We just invented this thing by writing down the Christoffel symbols. But this we don't know yet. This is the covariant derivative of omega for one form of a cotangent vector field. Now, let's contract. Let's take eta and evaluate it against omega. If I evaluate eta against omega, I get a number, I get a scalar function. And I can covariantly differentiate that. And that will give me, I get the covariant derivative of this, but it also obeys the Leibniz rule. Because remember that we can choose to first evaluate and then parallel transport, or first parallel transport, then evaluate. And the same is true for the covariant derivative. First covariantly differentiate, then evaluate. Around. So what we get is we have omega covariant derivative of eta in the direction of xi plus the other way around. Now, we also know, by the way, that this, being the covariant derivative of a scalar function, is just xi applied to omega eta, right? Xi being a direction vector, we know how it acts on a function. Okay. Okay, so what we have is that xi evaluated on the evaluation of omega against eta is omega of the covariant derivative this way and the covariant derivative that way, where this one is the one that we're interested in. So we can now use the equation that we just saw, you see, over here, and solve it for this thing. This is the thing we want to know. Okay, so we just put this on the other side. Okay, so we have that this is equal to that minus omega of Nabla eta xi. So we have that this, I wrote it here, is equal to that being equal to this minus this. Now, why is that equal to that? Remember, this is a scalar function. This is the covariant derivative of a scalar function. That's simply psi applied to the scalar function, psi applied to the scalar function. So what we have is this. The covariant derivative of a cotangent vector field in the direction of psi is given by this expression here. And now let's make the whole thing very explicit by choosing basis vectors. So for the omega, let's choose the dxj, and for the eta, let's choose d by dxi. Then given that we know the axioms and the Leibniz rule and stuff like that, once we know how the covariant derivative acts on this plane thing, we can work out how it acts on this with the coefficient function in front of it. Now, at this point, let me introduce a new notation. I had to introduce it at some point, and it felt natural at this point. When we have tangent vectors and cotangent vectors, then they can evaluate against each other to give us a function. And as I mentioned earlier in this lecture, this is just like brass and cats in quantum mechanics. So therefore, in differential geometry, often a similar notation to the Dirac notation is actually being used, where we say that if we have a tangent vector field and a cotangent vector field, and we evaluate them against each other, we write it like this. So we could say this is a cotangent vector field, which we feed a tangent vector field so that it eats it up and gives us a number at each point, so it gives us a function. But we can also write this as a kind of a bra and ket, right? So it's the evaluation of a dual vector against a vector. And that makes sense because of all these bracketing. See, it's you could also write here psi of omega, and sometimes we did. And then if we have lots of dependencies like of x, so sometimes it makes use to use these brackets, just like in quantum mechanics, but we don't use vertical bars here in differential geometry. We'll just use a comma in here. Okay, so it's like the omegas here, the cotangent vectors here, and the tangent vectors over there. Okay, so what do we have then? Then we have the covariant derivative of this cotangent vector. So we specialize. The omega is this one, and the eta is that one. Then by this formula above, we obtain that this is psi of omega evaluated on eta. Omega is d by dxj, eta is d by dxi, and the evaluation of the cotangent vector on the tangent vector is just this bracket thing. And then that's, of course, just a function. Right? When we evaluate this cotangent against this tangent vector, it's a function, and psi applied to a function, we know how that works, right? How a tangent vector different directionally differentiates a function to give us another function. And here we have the evaluation of omega, a cotangent vector, that is fed a tangent vector. The covariant derivative of a tangent vector in the direction of a tangent vector is a tangent vector. So we are feeding a tangent vector into a cotangent vector, which we can write in this way. This is the covariant derivative in the xi direction of d by dxi. So that's a tangent vector, and the omega was specialized to be the d by dxj. So here we have a cotangent vector evaluated against a tangent vector. Yeah. Okay, so that's what we have here. And what is this then? It turns out that, let me just see. Yeah, right. So we can put this psi in front of this. And then, oh, right. OK, so we know what this is. This is the Kronecker delta here. OK, if we evaluate the dual bases against each other, so therefore, these numbers are 0 and 1. And by the way, they are constant. So therefore, the derivative that is the derivatives contained in psi evaluate that to 0. So this goes away, and we're just left with this. But we know what that is. This is how we started the whole thing. We defined what the covariant derivative is on the basis vectors. And it was given by these Christoffel symbols that we pulled out of a hat. So This is what we get here. Now, these are scalar functions. Those guys are scalar functions. And they can be pulled out of that evaluation. And then we're just left with evaluating the dxj against the d by dxk, which gives us Kronecker deltas, which means we get a Kronecker delta between the j and the k index, which means that the k index goes away and we're just left with the j index. So therefore, the covariant derivative in the direction of xi of this cotangent vector, when evaluated against the tangent vector, is given by these coefficients. And from that, we can then read off, we are out of time. From that, we can then read off that the covariant derivative in an arbitrary direction of the basis vectors, canonical basis vectors, dxj, is given by this, which looks very similar to what we had for tangent vectors, except that these are the basis vectors that occur now naturally on the other side. And the index structure is accordingly adjusted. We're not summing over these, but we're summing over those index, this index here. And there's a minus sign. So now we know how cotangent vectors are to be covariantly differentiated. And I will skip this part. I will just tell you what it is. In the interest of time, it's the same procedure as what we just did, but generalized to arbitrary tensors. So what if we choose the coordinate basis, the canonical basis in the tangent space and cotangent spaces, the d by dxi, d by dxj, and we want to know how the covariant derivative acts on them. Then we utilize the same axioms, namely that the parallel transport commutes with tensor product building and with evaluation. And then we obtain the following result, namely that the covariant derivative of an arbitrary tensor with arbitrarily many contravariant and covariant components is given by the following expression. The direction vector xi can again be decomposed into coefficient functions times the d by dxi. These coefficient functions, as always, can be pulled out in front. Always linearity in the first argument. That's why we have the xi k here. And then we have here a bunch of these covariant and contravariant basis vectors because it's a general tensor. Here we have the coefficient functions of our tensor. And then we have here the semicolon, the covariant derivative of these coefficient functions. And it is defined in the following way. We get the ordinary derivative of the coefficient functions plus, for every contravariant index, we get the Christoffel symbols and contracted in this way. And we get lots of terms, as many as we have contravariant indices. And then we get, just like with the covariant, with the cotangent vectors, we get also terms with Christoffel symbols with a minus sign, as we just saw for the basis of the cotangent vector space, with a minus sign and a different index structure so that we now contract always the lower indices. Yeah, and that's the result. So overall, we've now calculated how to calculate the covariant derivative, that is to say, the affine connection, its action on arbitrary tensors. So now we can parallel transport anything, tangent vectors, cotangent vectors, any arbitrary tensors. And that, because we now know how to do parallel transport, in principle, we fixed the curvature of space and time by choosing our gammas. It's not obvious yet. We will see that how that all pans out. What we will have to do is relate this to a metric description and also consider what other possibilities there are to describe the shape of a space-time. See, it could be that the affine connection will be the winner and that quantum gravity ought to be done using an affine connection rather than a metric. Remember that, for example, in quantum mechanics, you don't have a metric. Just don't, right? We have the equivalent of tangent and cotangent vectors, right? There's brass and kits, but we don't have a metric where you would feed in two brass or two kits, right? Don't have that. So the metric seems a little alien from a quantum mechanical perspective. How about the affine connection? Is that something alien in quantum mechanics? Not really, because it comes up in all gauge theories. Electromagnetism is described, not barometric, but it has an affine connection. The weak interaction has an affine connection. The strong interaction has an affine connection. In electromagnetism, for example, what's the analog of the Christoffel symbol? Anybody know?
Vector potential.
Exactly, the A mu. The A mu play the role of the Christoffel symbols. And for QCD, you have a multi-index thing. These are non-commutative fields, operator matrix-valued vector potential fields. Which is why a lot of people are betting on the affine connection as winning the race towards quantum field theory, quantum gravity. Except, if it was so easy, somebody would have done it. Because this stuff is like 70 years old. We know gauge theories for a long time and gravity for a long time. It's not as straightforward. Just because both have affine connections doesn't mean that affine connections are the way to go. If it were straightforward, it would have been done. Now, the metric doesn't also look like it is the winning candidate there. So it may be up to one of you guys to figure out what is going to be the proper description of space-time curvature. And we will talk about a few other methods too. And then in the essay, you know, review what's there. Look, for example, at papers that use deficiency angles to describe a curvature and attempts to quantize gravity in this way. Whatever approaches you find, you know, discuss a little bit what you see and what advantages and disadvantages you see. I will later talk a little bit more about spectral geometry. Remember, where shape is determined through the sound of vibrations of that shape. That's something that I'm working on, for example. And I will link to a lecture that I gave, a talk that I gave in this room, actually, about spectral geometry, so that we don't use up an extra lecture for that, because it's specifically about my own work. So if you're interested in that, have a look into that. Okay, so we're done for today. See you on Friday. If you have any questions, let me know.